Thank you, Anne. My name is Bert Fraser-Reed, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm now a member of the Durham Central Group. And it's a real privilege and honor to be with you for this convention. And I guess first I should apologize to you, Anne, and to the other members of the organizing committee for being so late in getting here. I only got in this afternoon, but some last-minute problems came up. And I guess I'm only glad I was able to handle them. A few years ago, I would not have been able to handle them. But as Anne said, I spent several happy years here, met several people who are in the audience tonight, and I hope to meet up with all of you later. I know many people have asked me, who have not seen me for the 5 years that I've been away, and it is 5 years, you know. My gosh, where have the years gone? Many people seem to be worried about how I'm getting on in Durham. But I want to tell you I'm doing fine. Maybe it's because you've been hearing the story of the young black man who died and went to his reward, and he met St. Peter at the gates, and St. Peter said to him, "Young man, how is it now for a black man in Durham?" And he said, "Oh, it's pretty good, you know. It's a great place. Very, very booming city, no unemployment hardly." And he says, "You know, even black people like me now can even work at Duke University." And St. Peter said, "Gosh, I find that hard to believe." He says, "Oh, yeah. And, you know, we can even go to the Baptist church. You believe that, the white Baptist church?" He said, "No, I don't believe that. That I find hard to believe." He says, "Oh, yeah, I mean, a few Sundays ago, I went to the white Baptist church, and I was welcomed with open arms. They took me up to the front and introduced me to everybody. And 2 days later, the ministers came and got me and took me down to the river to baptize me. Funny, that's the last thing I remember." Well, I hope there are no Baptists here tonight. At least there should not be any Baptists, because Baptists don't drink. No, but I have enjoyed life in Durham. The AA down there is pretty good, too. And it's a great privilege and pleasure to be back here at this convention, because conventions have played a big part in my sobriety, as you will hear. Because it goes back now a few 24 hours. When I was at that time living and working at the University of Waterloo in Canada, and I woke up on the Tuesday realizing that I was too drunk to teach my classes. And so I canceled them, and this was the first time that I was going to cancel my classes because of alcohol. I had always boasted to my wife that I was the captain of my ship and the master of my fate, and that I was at every meeting or every seminar or every lecture that I was supposed to give, and she had to agree, because of a truth, I was always there in body and full of spirit. But on this Wednesday morning, things were to be different. I was not going to be able to make my classes, and I was a worried man. And when an alcoholic is worried, what does he do? He drinks some more. You have by now gathered that I'm a professor. Let me tell you further that I'm a professor of chemistry. And so at all times in my laboratory at the University of Waterloo, I had at least 32 gallons of alcohol, courtesy of the Canadian taxpayers. And so I took some of this lab alcohol home with me and continued to get drunk. Every night my wife would come home from work, she would see me, she would say to me, "Well, didn't you go to work today either?" Well, finally on Friday she said to me, "This has gone on long enough, I'm going to call Alcoholics Anonymous." By that time I was feeling so lousy, I didn't much care who she called. But next morning this man came over driving this great big Buick and in a coat and tie and really elegant. And he said, "My name is Keith. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "You don't look like an alcoholic to me." He says, "Oh yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm the president of the Chamber of Commerce," and so on and so on. I said, "That's not right." He said, "Well, look, tomorrow morning I'll come and take you to meet some alcoholics down at the Preston Scout House." So on Sunday morning I got up early, and I didn't want these alcoholics to think I was one of them. So I took some pills. I took a lot of pills because I had a lot of pills. They had been given to me by my doctor. Because, you see, my doctor seemed to believe that alcoholism was a form of Valium deficiency. And so as soon as I showed up on his doors, "Here you are, here, have some more." And so I took a handful of these Valium pills and went off to my AA meeting. And what I heard did not impress me one little bit. The man there, whose name I didn't care to learn, had been on Skid Row in Toronto, and that immediately put me off. I said, "He has been on Skid Row bumming off the Salvation Army doing all those dreadful things. I have not even been to a hospital." Well, I left Preston Scout House at 12 o'clock, and by 5 o'clock I had fixed that. Because I went straight back to my lab, forgetting about the Valium that I had loaded into my stomach earlier that morning, I continued now to drink the lab alcohol. And when I did not show up at the appointed time, my wife got suspicious, got the security guards to break my door down, and the next thing I knew, it was 11 o'clock at night, and there were all these bright lights and people in white around me, and there she was sitting across from me, and I said, "What happened?" She said, "Just take it easy," because I had been in the hospital. You see, in my very first encounter with Alcoholics Anonymous, I made a crucial mistake. I listened for what alcohol had done to the speaker, not what alcohol had done for him. Those people who were at Preston Scout House, I had, of course, long since forgotten about. But they had not forgotten about Bert, and so all week they came to the hospital, and I told them to leave, and they stayed. They said to me, "Bert, at the end of this week, there's going to be a convention in London, Ontario. Why don't you go?" And so I got out of the hospital on Friday, and I drove down to the 16th Ontario Convention in the city of London, Ontario, where what I was to see and what I was to learn was to change my life beyond measure. I saw 1,200 sober people who called themselves alcoholics, who were dancing as you will be doing later tonight, and I just could not believe it. It was a banquet like this. That convention, as indeed many conventions, played an important part in my sobriety. A few months after I had been in the program, I received a call from Witt. Witt was the organizer of that convention, and he had met me that Saturday. And Witt said to me, "Bert, I would like you to speak on the spiritual panel at the next convention." I said, "Wit, I've never spoken at a convention before." He said, "Well, make this your first." He said, "I want you to speak on God as you understand him." I said, "Wit, I've not even been in the program a year. I don't understand God. I don't know anything about God as I understand him." He said, "Well, speak on God as you don't understand him." What Wit and those other people told me that day makes it a privilege for me to tell you that if I can stay sober one day at a time until October the 13th of this year, I will be celebrating 20 years. And that very same convention, where I spoke at a convention for the first time, invited me to come back and speak there this October. My sponsor will be presenting me with my 20th year medallion. And I wanted Wit to be there, but that was not to be. Only on Monday of this week, I received a card from his lady saying he has passed on to his reward a month ago. 90 years of age, 42 of those in this program. I just wrote to her, thanking her and Wit for changing my life, and I can only hope and pray that his spirit still lives on through the likes of me. I was born in Jamaica, and I can skip over my early years because alcohol was not a problem to me. I did not grow up in an alcoholic home or anything like that. I left and went to Canada to go to university. And for most of that time, I can say alcohol was not a problem. I'm not prepared to say that I was a social drinker. I'm prepared to say that alcohol was not a problem. In fact, I was able to pursue my studies and also to pursue a very active career in music. I was the assistant organist at the Anglican Cathedral, and that called for me to be present every Sunday morning to play at 7 o'clock, and I was able to do that. But I graduated and won a scholarship. And I believe that that is where my problems began, because the scholarship brought a lot of money with it, and I also was playing a lot at the church. Well, for example, I used to get paid for weddings, because in those days young people got married. And so, you see, with all of this money coming to me, I was doing all right. And, you see, alcoholics cannot stand prosperity. I took to buying a bottle of booze per week. And it was my habit that when I came home from the lab, I would pour myself a little drink, I would read the newspaper, and all of this would get me nicely relaxed. And I say that is where my problems began, because in the space of a very few years, I was to see this one drink per night grow into something more like one bottle per night, with the result that I was now relaxed not only that night, but the morning following. But I was young, and I was strong, and it didn't cause me any problems. In fact, I won another scholarship. And this scholarship took me to Western Canada, to the city of Edmonton. Now, I don't know if you can remember the Calgary Winter Olympics and how cold it looked outside. Well, Edmonton is 200 miles further north. And in October, the temperature fell to 35 degrees below zero. And I said to myself, Bert, this is no place for a boy from the Caribbean. And so I resolved to get out as quickly as I could. I got out more quickly than I should, but not because of booze, it is because I did my work. And my professor said to me, Bert, that's fine, I'm not going to tell anyone that you're leaving ahead of time. You have done the work, you have worked very hard, go. But in the 3 years, less 2 months that I was to spend in Edmonton, a number of things were to change. And many of them had to do with that one drink per night. Because now several times I would be working away in my lab at nights, as is my habit, and it would come on me just like that. I said, hey, how much booze was there at home last night, Bert? And you know, I couldn't quite remember. I said, well, it's best not to take any chances here. Just put everything down, drive down to the liquor store, buy a bottle, put it in the trunk. You see, I did not need to drink from the bottle. All I needed to know was that the bottle was there. And come 11 o'clock that night, it would be waiting for me. I needed that assurance. Well, there are things which I remember, as I'm sure it's the same thing with you, and you wonder why you remember them. They seem so trivial, so unimportant. I can remember going into my basement apartment in Edmonton one lunchtime, turning the radio on, and there was a man talking to the radio host, and he said, I am an expert on alcoholism, and I can tell you that if at any time of the day or night your body calls for a drink, you are an alcoholic. And I was offended by those words, because that is not what I had heard. I had heard that if you take a drink in the mornings, you're an alcoholic. Yeah, that's what I heard. And there are several mornings when I would wake up and there would be some booze left over in the glass from the night before, and I did not drink it because I knew what I would be risking. Mind you, I didn't throw it away either. After all, we are sick people. We are not stupid people. I was not into throwing out booze. No, I poured it back into the bottle, and I said to him, well, look, mister, if at any time I need to quit drinking, I will do so with the exercise of willpower. And for those of you who are sneering at that remark, who don't know about my willpower, I'm going to tell you about it. And I'm going to apologize before I do, because particularly now that I live in North Carolina, I have to be careful about what I'm about to say. Because you see, in 1963, I used to smoke between 2 and 3 packs of cigarettes a day. And that was the first year I read of the evidence linking smoking to lung cancer, and I believed it, and I said, Bert, if at your early age you're smoking that much, you're going to be in trouble, so you'd better quit. Well, I was coming up for my last major set of exams in July of 1963, and I said, that's the time to quit, when the pressure is off, when the exams are finished, and that's what I did. I quit on the 31st of July 1963, and I have not smoked since. So, you see, I knew that I had willpower. And I figured that if there was a remote case that I needed to quit drinking, you know, a remote chance that I needed to quit drinking, I would do so by the exercise of that same willpower. Unfortunately, today I know certain things I did not know then. Today I have a better understanding of this disease that causes all of us to be here. This addiction, this compulsion that drove our relatives crazy, our friends crazy, drove us crazy, that we had to have that drink. Scientists have not been able to understand where this compulsion comes from. Scientists have very good theories about why heroin is addicting, why coffee is addicting, why tobacco is addicting, but my goodness, nothing about booze should be addicting. Well, this lady scientist, Dr. Virginia Davies at Baylor College of Medicine, decided to try and find out why alcohol was addicting. And as most of these chemists in this type of study do, she got herself a bunch of rats, four-legged rats, and divided them into two. And she fed one bunch of them booze until they became drunkards. And now she had two sets of rats, a drunken set and a straight set. And she was able to compare these two sets of rats. And she found that in the case of the healthy rats, when they took alcohol into their system, the alcohol goes to the liver, where it is broken down into bits and pieces, and it passes out of the system. The body also breaks down proteins. The proteins also go to the liver. They are broken down and they pass out of the system. So in the case of the healthy rats, there were two parallel streams, one from the alcohol going to the liver, being broken down and passed out, one from the proteins going to the liver and being passed out. However, in the case of the alcoholic rat, she found that a change had taken place so that the breakdown products from the alcohol and from the protein, instead of passing out of the system, these breakdown products were actually combining and being retained in the body of these alcoholic rats. So she sacrificed these rats and isolated from their system this new compound which was being formed and classified it and found that it belongs to the same family of chemicals as does morphine, codeine, and heroin. It's an opiate narcotic. It's a very interesting name. Tetrahydropropylene is the name. And it is her theory that the body chemistry of these alcoholic rats had so changed that when they ingested alcohol, their body manufactured this addicting substance. And I'm sure many of you sitting in this room will say amen to that, because don't we know that that one drink will trigger it all? And of course, many of you know about cross addiction. Well, I had several occasions to speak to Dr. Virginia Davies about this, and I believed her theory. I think it's a great theory. My only problem with it was that she produced it in 1970, and I needed it in 1963. So you see, I had no alternative but to keep on drinking. I got married in 1963. And really, that had nothing to do with my alcoholism. Although that's not what I said. You see, when I came into this program and heard the old-timers, some of the old-timers talking about how they used to beat up their women folk, I said, oh, how disgusting. Because I had not struck my wife when I was drunk, nor for that matter when I was sober. I did not brutalize my children. And so I thought that I was a cut above those men. until the ex-town drunk Lee talked to me from time to time and made me understand just what honesty is all about in this program. And then from talking to Lee, I discovered that what I did not used to do with my fists, I used to do with my tongue. You see. Because I can quite remember how venomous I would get. Little did I know how disturbed my wife was watching me deteriorate over the 5 years that we were married before I joined this program. She had been going to our doctor to seek advice from him. Little did I know. I didn't know that. But when out of her love and affection for me, when it got too much to bear, she said to me, "Look, Bert, don't you see what is happening to you? You're becoming an alcoholic." I turned upon her with all the fury I could muster and I said, "Well, who would not be an alcoholic being married to you?" It was cruel. It was unkind. It was calculated. It would have hurt her less if I had hit her in her mouth. Because don't forget what I told you at the beginning of my talk, who it was that placed the call to AA and who is responsible for me being here tonight. And after nearly 20 years in the program, I need to come back to you people so that you will keep me honest. Because you see, the same tongue is still in my head. The same one. And when Bert does not get his way, it can strike out with the same venom it did almost 20 years ago. The only difference being that if you people have taught me anything in these nearly 20 years, it is that if I do that, I must take an eighth step. But I won another scholarship. And this one took me to England. And boy, this is where my alcoholism really took off. I don't understand why, because booze in England is so expensive. Mind you, it's not expensive if you drink the way English people drink. You know, pale brown ale. I mean, you guys were over there in the war, you know, half and half, bitter. Guinness, strong ale. I didn't drink those things. I only drank beer in an emergency. I liked hard liquor, and hard liquor in England was expensive. But of course, expense was no problem to me because I was on a very lucrative Canadian scholarship. And when I converted my Canadian dollars to English pounds, I was one of the best paid people at Imperial College of Science. But I was to soon discover that there was more to it than money. I had been given a tremendous opportunity to study in England. I was to study with one of England's famous chemists, indeed one of the world's most famous chemists. The man is a Nobel Prize winner. And you know that when he asks you to come to work in his lab for a period of 2 years, the pleasure is all yours. But how am I showing up? Well, I'm not showing up much before 10:30 because the pubs didn't open till 10. In England, they have a sneaky way to do things over there. They open the pubs after the men have gone to work. Well, you see, my time was flexible, so I came in at 10:30. Now, they close the pubs at 3, which means that I had to get there before 3 for an afternoon refresher to see me through the afternoon. And then, of course, I went home after 7 when the pubs were, everything was rolling. That was my pattern. One day I passed out in the lavatory for 5 hours, which just shows how strict the security is in that building. I could have been hurt, you know. But that is how I was acting. And don't think that I was not troubled. I have made my peace, by the way, with that man. After I had been sober a few years, I went back to England and I took the opportunity to visit him. And I said to him, "Sir Derek, I have to tell you that when I was here working for you, I was fighting alcoholism, and I would like to make my amends to you." He said to me, "You were fighting what?" I said, "I was fighting alcoholism." He says, "Well, you sure fooled me. I thought you were doing a great job." The person who benefited most from my making that amend was not him. It was me. If there is anyone here who is hesitant about making an amend, remember that the person you're going to help most with that amend is not him or her. It is number one. Anyway, we lived in this lovely apartment. It was an alcoholic's paradise. There were nooks and crannies and holes where I could hide my booze. Why I'm hiding my booze? My wife hardly drank. We had a little daughter born to us. She didn't drink. Milk, maybe. One morning I thought I was well hidden when I heard behind me, "Bert, why are you drinking in the mornings now?" Well, you know how it is when you're caught red-handed. What do you do now? My goodness, what do I do now? Well, I did the same thing you did to your spouse. I put her at ease. Now, did you remember how you used to put your spouse at ease? "Oh, you worry too much." "My goodness, you get excited easily." "I have this thing under control," I said to her. You see, not realizing that when I said to my wife, "I have my drinking under control," I was taking the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was admitting that I was powerless over alcohol. Because, you see, as far as I am concerned, the only person who has anything to control with regard to booze is an alcoholic. The social drinkers have nothing to control. Now, I realize that that's strange. And, you know, I don't understand it, and I suspect you don't understand it either. How can we understand it? Because social drinkers are strange people. Do you know they never go on the wagon? They also sometimes say funny things. Sometime you offer them a drink, they say, "No, thank you." Strange people. Well, I'll tell you how much control I exercised. We had been planning this camping trip, which was going to last 6 weeks throughout Europe. And I had this little English station wagon all equipped with our babies, things and everything. And as soon as that little thing got off the ferry in France, I zeroed in over the Alps, heading towards Italy. I had been told that the expensive part of the wine in Italy were the bottles, and so I took some bottles with me. And I had them filled up at the corner store for 35 cents. And I said to my wife, I cannot believe this. This good red Chianti for 35 cents. Do you realize in Canada, this would have cost us more like $3.50? Do you see how much money I am saving? And I saved money before breakfast, during breakfast, after breakfast. I said to my wife, I cannot get enough of this good red Chianti into me. And who was Bert kidding? Because Bert had got to that stage of alcoholism where I didn't much care what I drank. And the proof of that was to come when we went to Greece. We drove along the streets. And the streets were empty because they had just overthrown Papandreou, not this one, of course, his father. And the soldiers were searching my little van for arms. There were none in it, of course. But there were men sitting under the piazzas drinking stuff which looked like this, and I said, I cannot believe it. Grown men sitting around drinking water. Until we met the Greek lady who said, oh, no, it's not water, it's a Greek drink, ouzo. And if you drink too much of it, it will make you blind. Well, as a scientist, I knew what in there made you blind. I knew that it was methyl alcohol or methanol or wood alcohol, whatever name you knew it by. I knew that. I even knew how it made you blind. I knew it goes into your mouth. It doesn't have to wait to get into your stomach, to enter your bloodstream. It can enter right through the cheeks. And it goes through the bloodstream to your liver, because the liver is a big garbage disposal unit where it is oxidized to formaldehyde, known more commonly as embalming fluid. And that goes back into the bloodstream and is taken up to the optic nerve, which it attacks irreversibly. I knew all of that. But I got thirsty. And maybe I said, oh, it would hurt the Greeks, but it should not hurt a West Indian. You see, that word sanity is in the second step for a reason. The second year we spent in London, we were privileged to take another exciting trip. It was a trip laid on to the Soviet Union by the University Association of England, and 30 of us students went over. And this, mind you, was at a time long before they were opening their borders to tourists. My wife, of course, had all sorts of plans and ideas about what she was going to see and all of these things which she laid out. Well, as soon as I got off the train in Moscow, I made eyeball-to-eyeball contact with Chuck, an exchange student from Minnesota, and Chuck and I soon found out the best way to save money in Moscow. My poor wife was in tears. And I was not to understand why, or even to care. But shortly thereafter, we returned to Canada, and I assumed my job at the University of Waterloo, about 70 miles north of Buffalo, a place which is probably responsible for some of you being here tonight, because it is the birthplace of the Seagram's distilleries. I wanted to do well, don't we all? I have heard people stand up at meetings such as this and say, I did not know what was wrong with me. I thought that my drinking was okay. I thought it was okay to have blackouts. I do not have that excuse. I knew that alcohol was destroying me in every single department of my life. I knew that. What I did not know was what to do about it. But I tried. I tried certain things. As stupid as it may seem, I changed brands. That, of course, didn't I even made my own liquor. But now, even worse than the drunkenness came the remorse. You know, that's a word I don't hear as much again as I used to when I came in, remorse. Because you see, I believe that if there is anything that differentiates between the alcoholic in this program and the alcoholic outside of this program, it is that we in here cannot live with remorse. Because now I was getting awake at 2 and 3 in the mornings, realizing that I had betrayed myself once again. I would like to tell you about the 12-step call which I made to a man, and I walked in and I asked, as I frequently do, "Have you been to AA before?" And before he could answer, his wife says, "Oh, he went once, but he was so disgusted he didn't go back." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, you know, there was a man up there talking about all the dreadful things he was doing. He should have been ashamed to be talking about all of that in public. And if he wasn't bad enough, the audience, they were worse because they were laughing and encouraging him. I was so disgusted I didn't go back." I said to him, "Sir, it's a pity you only went to the one meeting. Because had you been to a few more meetings, you would have understood what was taking place. That man up there is talking about things which have happened to him, and whether he likes it or not, it is indelibly burned into his memory. It's a part of his mental fabric." And the audience laughter, sir, was not a laughter of approval, as you seem to think. The laughter was their way of saying to him, "We understand and we forgive you." And if the audience laughter is important, the laughter of the speaker is even more important, because when the speaker laughs, it means that he has forgiven himself. And until the speaker in this program learns that yesterday is but a dream, the healing which they write about in the big book cannot begin. I said to him, "Don't knock that laughter you hear in the halls of AA. It is the surest sign that there is healing going on." I said, "I want to tell you about the Friday night when my wife came home. She was pregnant with our second child. And she said to me, 'Bert, there are complications and the doctor wants me in the hospital right away.' I said to her, 'Well, okay, you go ahead and pack your things. I just have to go down to the lab to turn off an experiment.'" See, scientists always have experiments to turn on or off. But that night, my experiment was not at the lab. It was at the liquor store. I went and bought a whole bunch of booze and put it in the trunk. I came back and I took her to the hospital. And I guess I must have said to her all of those helpful things the husband ought to say to his wife when she goes in to face major surgery. Take it easy. And then I went back now and started to think about it. Now, as you know, we alcoholics are very sensitive people, aren't we? Yeah. Oh, yeah, we are sensitive. We are easily moved, easily touched. And when we have a loved one in hospital about to face major surgery, our compassion knows no bounds. In circumstances such as these, we tend to worry, do we not? And that's what I did. I opened the bottle and started to worry. And I worried as long and as hard as I could that night. And as soon as I surfaced next morning, I said I worried some more because the doctor hadn't phoned. I worried. Well, eventually the man did phone and he said to me, "I'm happy to tell you that your wife has given birth to a little boy, a brother to your daughter, and both the little boy and your wife are just fine. And it is only an alcoholic sitting in this room tonight that can understand the burden and the weight that was lifted from my poor shoulders." You're way ahead of me. I could now celebrate, and I celebrate. And I celebrated so intensely for the next week that I forgot to pick them up. And when my wife came into this house of celebration, she said, "What's been going on?" I said, "I have been celebrating." She said, "You call this a celebration?" And you see, if she only knew the truth, because I was trying to celebrate, you know. Oh, yes. Because when I was 17 and 18, I used to be able to go out with the boys and have a little bit of fun. A few drinks were had, and everybody had a good time. And here was I, at age 33, trying to do the same and not understanding why it hadn't happened. Why had alcohol turned against me? I looked across at my wife and I saw tears on her face. They were not tears of joy. Her comments were that she regretted the birth of our son under these conditions. "Why did you come into the hospital drunk?" she said to me. The hospital, mind you, where she was assistant director of nursing. I said, "I did not mean to." She said, "If you did not mean to, why did you do it?" And I did not know what to say to her. But if you had been there, you would have known what to say. You would have said to her, "It just happened." Because isn't that the way it goes? The alcoholic does not have to make a resolution that he's going to do something stupid. He just has to take a drink and it just happens. I wish I could have told you that that was my last drunk, but it was not. I've told you my last drunk before. I have told you about that convention in London at the beginning. I've told you about Witt, who died a few months ago at 9 years old. These people at that convention said to me, "Bert, if you can just try to practice these 12 steps in your affairs, we guarantee that you will find what we have." I said, "Oh, great. Give them to me here." And I started to go down, and I could not find the one I wanted. Because I figured that one of those 12 steps would deal with hangovers. Because, you see, my problem was the hangovers. I figured that one... No hangover steps. Because I was to learn in this program that I believe I could have lived with the physical defects of this disease for another 50 years, maybe. The dry heaves, the palpitations. Oh my goodness. I think I could have lived with those for another 50 years, but long before that. I don't know. I used to get really suicidal at 2 and 3 in the morning. And just the thought of it sends shivers up my spine. Because can there be any greater evidence of spiritual breakdown than when someone in good health sits down to contemplate suicide? The steps talked about making amends. And I was to discover what amends meant probably 3 years into the program. Because I was ill on the couch, and my little girl, who was then 6 years old, said, "What's the matter, Daddy? Aren't you feeling well?" I said, "No, dear." And she was clearly worried. She left the room and came back in a moment and said, "Daddy, I hope you're not going to be sick again like that time the ambulance had to come to get you." 3 years had passed, and she hadn't said a word. 3 years, and that little child had not said a word. Can you imagine how much anxiety I caused her? At whatever age or stage you come into this program, I believe we owe a great debt of gratitude to AA. But I believe those of us who come in when our children are still young have a double debt of gratitude. And I personally am grateful to this program, because I believe that there were no lasting scars on that young lady. Indeed, I am happy to report that she will be among you very shortly, because she's just been admitted to Georgetown Law School. They told me to go to meetings. And in these nearly 20 years, I guess I have heard people from every imaginable walk of life speak. And I have come to the conclusion that all of us alcoholics have one thing in common, and it is that we hated ourselves. We hated ourselves because we were too tall, too short, too fat, too thin, too sexy, not sexy enough, too rich, too poor, too powerful, not powerful enough. And what we were trying to do is to use alcohol as a curtain that we could pull across that aspect of ourselves that we did not like. Only thing, when we awakened at 2 and 3 in the mornings, we knew it had not worked. Alcoholics Anonymous does not promise to cure those defects. It does not promise to make you rich if you were not rich before, handsome if you were not handsome before. What it promises, I believe, is in these 12 steps to make you come aware of a God of your own understanding, who will grant you the serenity to accept the things you cannot change, the courage to change the things you can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That is the promise of this program, and I believe if you keep coming back day after day, night after night, you will come to that realization of that God of your understanding. And there are people out there who do not know what it is that you and I are seeking in here tonight. And I am not talking about the alcoholics. I am talking about the normal people. The normal people whose lives are twisted by envy, fear, jealousy, prejudice, malice, greed, but whose problems with life are no less than ours used to be. How lucky are you and I that when I woke up in the hospital, realizing I'd nearly killed myself from mixing booze and pills? Or you when the judge sentenced you? Or you when your wife kicked you out? How lucky are you and I when we came to that moment of truth? There were those doors through which we could walk. There was that big book that we could read to gain wisdom. And there were those 12 steps that we could use to reconstruct our lives. How lucky are you and I? My sponsor promised me that things would happen to me in this program that exceeded my wildest expectations. And anyone who has been around, you know the story. You know of the person who was fired, who now owns the company. The person whose father kicked him out, who now is the president. The person who was refused permission to see his family by the courts, who is now the head of his household. The stories are all there. And I can think of the summer in 1968 when I went to a conference in Fredericton, Canada, and was so drunk I did not even meet my friends. The boys I went to school with, I wouldn't associate with them because at that time I was drinking in the mornings. And it has been my privilege to go from being afraid to speak to my friends at a conference to be privileged to speak to conferences in several places. I leave here tomorrow to go to Rhode Island for a conference. Next week I go to Vermont. Later next month I go to Sweden. In September to Switzerland. In October to India. In January to Indonesia. Who would have believed it? I certainly didn't. Not when I was drunk at that conference. Not when I was drunk in my office in 1968. But among all of those things, I want to share with you something which means even more to me than that, because it happened right here in this city. I had traveled around the world because of chemistry, and I had flown back from Japan that day, and my family met me at the airport, National Airport. And my son rushed over, broke the barriers, came and gave me a great big hug and said, "I didn't realize you were going to be away all of 7 weeks. I really missed you, Dad." In this program, you hear about spiritual awakening and spiritual effects. And you know, we expect the thunderbolt and the flash of lightning, while our most meaningful spiritual experiences are what pass us by. Because you see, it took me a while to appreciate the spiritual experience it was of this young man telling me he missed me. Because you see, that's the boy I left in the hospital. He is now 19 years old. He's right here in D.C., not this weekend, but he's working here for the summer. He goes to college in Canada. And he has never seen me drunk because I came to you people when he was 5 months old. For that, I am grateful to you. As we leave this place, the nurturing of this convention, we go back out to face the world around us, and that's when the pressures begin. That's when the pressures resume. As we walk our common road to recovery, it is well that we understand one thing that we alcoholics all share in common. And it is the belief that if anything is worthwhile doing, it is worthwhile doing to excess. That is our motto. That's why we share so much in common, and that is why we should remember the words of the Connecticut poet, of the Indiana poet, Max Ehrman. I do not know if Max was an alcoholic, but if he was not, he must have had good friends who were. Because surely the lines he wrote were meant for the ears of alcoholics. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt, the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be, and whatever your labors or your aspirations. In the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul, for with all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be careful. Strive to be happy. One day at a time.